We are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shootings, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Well, when you think of dignity of man, I bet you don't think of Kim Jong-un. What do you think when you hear the words North Korea? Dangerous, nuclear-powered madman, I imagine. Even though they have no reason to test nuclear missiles, they keep on doing it. Are they a uniquely repressive regime? That much seems clear. But how is it that North Korea has suddenly shot into the spotlight while Russia's ties to Trump and America's own very recent attacks on Syria and Afghanistan have faded from the headlines? How likely is it that the two bizarre madmen, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, might actually trigger a nuclear war? Today on Keeping Democracy Alive, we're going to talk about what's really going on behind the incredibly frightening drift toward war with North Korea. Our guest on Keeping Democracy Alive today, once again, Patrick Lawrence, foreign policy columnist at The Nation. Patrick, so good to have you back on again.
What a pleasure, Bert.
Well,
Thank you. Thanks.
While in South Korea recently, Vice President Mike Pence cited Trump's strength, that's his word, and willingness to use force, and warned, quote, North Korea would do well not to test his resolve, end of quote. It does seem that the two heads of state are perfectly matched. Two clearly immature, unpredictable, egotistical, impulse-driven men sitting on massive, trigger-happy, nuclear-loaded military machines. But of course, this is the easy snapshot of the moment, and it may not be fully accurate. Maybe the appearance of unpredictable irrationality is intentionally cultivated in North Korea. Patrick Lawrence, in your article in The Nation, you write that the missile tests bear a more sophisticated interpretation than we have had to date. Further, you write that acknowledging historical facts, facts the rest of the world is perfectly aware of, but facts most Americans have either purposely obscured, forgotten, or never knew, is essential to any successful exchange with Pyongyang, end of quote. Of course, every American has at least heard of the Korean War of the early 1950s, but until reading your articles, I must say, I had no idea of the effects of that war on the people of North Korea. What should we know that might tell us something about their seemingly aggressive posture today?
Well, Bert, first of all, we have to take the madman imagery and set it aside and look through an historical lens at the North Korean situation. I think in the column noted, I use the word trauma, okay? This is a traumatized nation, a traumatized people, a traumatized leadership, certainly. Kim Il-sung, Jong-un's grandfather, founder of DPRK, witnessed the firebombing of Pyongyang. He was there. The Americans are on record that it's been very well described. It's right up there with Dresden and Tokyo. It was an absolutely savage campaign. I think Curtis LeMay said it went on for 3 years. 20% of the population of North Korea was bombed, burned, what have you, however one dies in these things. And it is not forgotten. How could it be?
You must
equip oneself with this kind of historical knowledge in order to look at our situation now and understand it. I don't take madman, crazy, you know, we go after everything, his haircut, whatever, you know, eccentric, inexplicable, not quite human. I don't take any of it the slightest bit seriously. We have a very, very small nation that has had on its very doorstep an exceedingly hostile military that happens to be the largest in the world for 72 years. I really would like to invite your listeners to consider some analogous situation, I don't know, along the Canadian border or the Mexican, right? To use an old term, it's freak out material.
Yeah.
All right, this is a tiny little country, and what it wants above all, above anything else, it wants a treaty with the United States. It wants normalized relations. It's on the record 100 times with this objective. Whenever it is given a chance to go after that in a way that does not make it vulnerable, it takes that chance. We have given it that chance in the past. In the 90s, you and I were chatting a minute before we came on the air. Bush won
right.
In 1991, unilateral withdrawal of all American nuclear warheads from South Korean soil and from naval vessels in South Korean waters. Okay, 2 years later, Clinton inherited that situation. We had what we called the agreed framework. There was quite a lot of promise in these passages. They went on for some time. The agreed framework collapsed because the Americans did not keep their word. We promised, your listeners may remember, there was a quite severe famine at the time in North Korea. And also, if they were going to drop the nuclear program, they had energy problems. So we promised fuel oil, heating oil, by cargo ship, and I think food aid. I'd have to check that. In any event, we didn't give them any. Oh, we also promised to build 2 light water reactors that could not produce weaponized material. There wasn't a shred of effort to build those reactors. There was never any intention of building them. And we didn't. The agreed framework came apart when we declined to send the fuel oil. So then we went back to hostility in 2003. I'll cut this off in a sec. We had the opening of what were called the 6-party talks, North Korea on one side of the table, America, Japan, South Korea, China, and Russia on the other side of the table. They also were quite promising. This is under Jong-un's father, okay?
Kim Jong-un.
And Obama came into office, and those talks were off. They were looking a little forlorn for a time. Obama just canceled them. And here we are. But my point, just to sum up here, is that the North Koreans are on for talks if we give them the opportunity. I think you can take these recent missile launches since Trump took office and turn them upside down from the prima facie interpretation. Why did he do that? Because Trump was saying, I want to talk to the Russians, right? And Jong-un said, oh, I'll have some of that. This guy is into negotiation. I want to either dump or renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal. That's interesting. Your listeners can probably figure out where I'm headed here. If he's going to renegotiate the nuclear deal with Iran, maybe he's on for talking to me. So he made some noise. That's my upside down interpretation of what's been going on lately.
Well, it's always more than meets the eye, Lord knows, especially lately. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest once again, we're talking about North Korea realities versus the cartoon image that we get. Patrick Lawrence, foreign policy columnist at The Nation. Fascinating that from what you just described, it seems to me probably the two most, dare I say, sane presidents with the best, most realistic policies toward having some peace with North Korea might have been Bush 1 and 2. That I find fascinating.
It is very interesting to consider this from our domestic political perspective, Democrats, Republicans.
Uh-huh.
But don't forget, the Pentagon carries a lot of weight in the context of the Korean Peninsula. We have many thousands of troops in South Korea. It's a militarized situation. It has been since 1953. We can't put that aside. In the case of Trump, I wrote in a column last week, Trump was willing to talk to Kim Jong-un. I don't know whether your listeners are aware of that.
I wasn't aware of that.
Among his other I'd like to talk to moments, he included Kim Jong-un. Okay, he's a transactional man, one reason he has now lost control of his foreign policy, it has been taken from him, is because he was willing to talk to Russia, primarily the Russian situation, but also North Korea. Okay, we Americans need these zones of conflict for reasons you and I have discussed numerous times before. We need them. South Korea is extremely important as an outpost of American power in the Western Pacific. Any thought that we might actually make peace with the North Koreans, it doesn't sit well at the Pentagon. That's a very bitter reality, but there it is. There's nothing too complicated about it.
Well, it's fascinating how Trump has yielded his foreign policy and military policy decision-making. He's said very clearly, I've just given it over to the military.
It's a monumental pity. And of those of your listeners who are on the Russia, Russia, Russia bandwagon, I invite them to consider once again, or perhaps for the first time, the consequences of what they have done. Trump is many of the things most of us think, but he had some very sound foreign policy decisions. Primary among them was, I want to talk to the Russians. This was caricatured as bromance and all this other nonsense.
Oh, right.
Essentially, he saw opportunities in a better relationship with Russia. So do I.
Yeah.
Because Trump was quite, if you go back into the campaign, he was quite serious on that point. He's not a man of great reserves of conviction or intellectual ballast, but he was very serious on that point.
He did seem
over
to be.
Over and over, he went to it.
Yeah.
That was a sound position. And I'm writing about this as we speak. The primary reason the whole Russiagate thing erupted was to disrupt that trend in the Trump camp. That's it.
Similar.
And those, I don't like these words anymore, those on the left, progressives, whatever you want to call them,
same,
who climbed onto this, they really should think about what they have done or assisted in doing.
Interesting. Well, I mean, we've discussed before, I mean, when it comes to Iran and places like that, working with the Russians and not demonizing them quite so much. Now, I mean, there's much to, you talked about here that, you know, Trump, it did seem to me that during the campaign, one of the few things that I thought made at least a little bit of sense was a different foreign policy, not as aggressive, not as frankly imperialist and you know, military oriented as we've been for the past 20, 30, 40 years or so, and that he wanted to roll that back a little bit. And frankly, that's one of the reasons he was elected. It got a lot of strength. But he said, we have given them, he told reporters recently, quote, we have given them, the military, total authorization. He's adopted a traditional right-wing idealization of the military and its missions. So it's interesting to me. And you know, we have to look at history here. To my surprise, you pointed out that the heightened emergency has been induced that, quote, it was more or less scheduled to proceed no matter who took the White House last November. Your article points out that Hillary Clinton once made the case that the South China Sea might just as well be named the American Sea.
That was in one of her speeches, one of her, I don't even remember who she gave it to, probably a military constituency of some kind, I don't know, or a foreign policy association or something. I don't think it was a campaign speech, but in any event, whoever was listening to it, yeah, she said that. The theme was countering China and so on and so forth. I mean, look, Bert, do we want somebody leading this country willing to say something so patently ridiculous as that?
I did not agree with her foreign policy, that's for sure. I was very
For starters.
She was very, very militaristic and tremendously hawkish and during the campaign.
Her verb, she still is. She's right out there.
Oh, I wish she would go away, disappear, help the Democratic Party. That's the subject of another show, I'm sure. What were her designs on the region? And Obama, too. I mean, as you said, the heightened emergency has been induced that it was more or less scheduled to proceed no matter who took the White House in November.
Right. Here's my take on this question. In the North Korea situation, there are two perceived adversaries. There is the North Korean government, yes, and their nuclear programs, which are worrisome. I'm not saying they're not. I'll return to that point in a minute. And that's obvious. And there is China. America has policed the Western Pacific from the Korean Peninsula down to Australia since 1945. That's ours.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Quotation.
We
marks.
Own it. Yeah.
China inevitably has one. China's emergence as a regional and global power is inevitable. Two.
Yes. Absolutely.
A power of this kind is going to want a role in its own security.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Now, that is why China is the second unstated adversary in this Korean crisis. We are essentially telling the Chinese, this is ours to manage. Now, you go over there and tell the North Koreans to get in line. If you don't, we have the Vinson off the carrier group off the peninsula at some point when they finally get it up there. And we are ready to go. That's one reason they sent missiles into Syria while Trump was having chocolate cake with Xi Jinping. That was not an accident. The timing of that was not an accident. So, look, The emergence of China is probably, as I suggested, I place great emphasis on the Russian situation. But if I had to put numbers on these things, I might say the emergence of China and the adjustment of power relations in the Pacific is probably or may be the number one question facing us in the 21st century in the context we're discussing now. Number one, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what has happened? Until Obama was elected, there was no question of a military-first policy in the Pacific. I've served as a correspondent over there for 20-odd years.
Yes.
It's perfectly plain. The Pentagon runs Asia policy. There's no issue of that,
wow.
Right?
Yeah.
Obama came along with his sort of spongy ideas to my fundamental critique of Obama is he adjusted the means of policy. He did not touch the ends of policy, the purpose of what we're trying to do.
He
okay,
finessed,
so he comes along, and he's not really a military first man. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And he comes up with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Anybody who understands this agreement knows that it looked like a trade agreement. It wasn't even that. It was actually a deregulatory regime. But we'll set that point aside.
Yeah.
It was, more than anything else, a strategic device to counter China's influence. That's why China wasn't invited in. That's why everybody else around China was urged very strongly to join. So what was Obama doing? Was he altering the fundamentally confrontational stance America has held vis-a-vis China since the 1949 revolution? No, he did not. He did not alter that. He fiddled around with the means, right? Obama's now gone. The TPP is sunk. And the Pentagon is back in charge. We have Defense Secretary Mattis, and his conduit into the White House is H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor. These two are very close in their thinking, and this is what you get.
It reminds me a bit of Korea in 1951. When President Truman famously fired General MacArthur for his attempt to usurp the legitimate authority of the civilian government over foreign and military policy. It's incredible to me that what Trump basically, giving carte blanche to the military now, and his seeming disregard and disinterest in,
right.
in reality's foreign policy, I wonder if November 8, 2016, kind of had the result of being a military coup in the United States. I mean, reversing what happened in Korea in 1951 MacArthur being fired.
People don't like these terms, silent coup and deep state and all this sort of thing. These are called conspiracy theories.
Well,
parenthetically, I don't know why the term conspiracy theory has acquired this magical ability to dismiss anybody's opinion. Oh, that's a conspiracy theory.
Right.
I don't have any problem with conspiracy theories.
Sometimes they're true.
Right. But where were we, Bert?
Well, I was just wondering, is it in effect a military coup now? I mean, is...
I don't think November 8th... I'm a little upside down from... I'm a little perpendicular to you on this, Bert. I don't think November 8th was any sort of coup-like moment.
Not intentionally.
Okay? In fact, I think November 8th was threatened to be a serious setback to the military, and I'm okay for the term the deep state, right?
Yeah.
Why? I'll name three positions that Trump took.
Yep.
One, He wanted a better relationship with Russia. Two, he wanted to negotiate in general with adversaries of all kinds. Three, he opposed military adventure of all kinds, imperial adventure
yes.
of all kinds, as wasteful, right?
Yes.
Corollary, what in the world is NATO all about,
yeah.
right?
Right.
So these were problems.
But now that he's...
The coup came... All right.
Yeah.
The coup, if let's stay with the term, just sort of for convenience sake, the coup began on November 8th, but it wasn't his election is what prompted it. It didn't mark it. Okay.
Right.
If you look at this spring, Russiagate reached such an extraordinary intensity.
Pitch. Yeah.
He lost his national security advisor. Then they went after Sessions. I'm not suggesting I admire any of these people,
yeah.
but they were Trump's people.
Yeah.
His inner circle at the White House, I'm told by people who in Washington, is more or less cleared out of anyone who will stand against the Mattis McMaster position on foreign policy. He doesn't have anybody around him,
mm-hmm.
all right?
Mm-hmm.
What happened in recent weeks? He was forced to capitulate, okay,
mm-hmm.
with his total authorization
right.
announcement. And what happened? We had the false flag chemical attack in Syria, and if your listeners doubt what I'm saying, I refer them to a very perspicacious scientist at MIT named Theodore Postol. You'll find him on the web. He has thoroughly, and with admirable disinterest, discredited the charge that this was can be laid at the feet of Damascus. So we have the cruise missiles into Syria.
Yep.
We have that strange Lovian bomb in Afghanistan.
Yes, indeed.
And then if your listeners really want a pivot to Asia, well, they've got one now.
That's
we went
sure.
right to North Korea.
Yep.
This is within a few weeks of President Trump's total authorization.
Well, it does seem...
Remark.
Yeah, kind of like this was, you know, in discussing this here, perhaps it's more real, more accurate to say that it was kind of the military saw that they had a pliable so-called president and that he didn't know what the heck he was doing. So the military has asserted itself and had sort of an internal
yeah.
coup against Trump, who was not beholden to them at first.
He wasn't.
Wow.
And, you know, he was an outsider.
Yeah.
Remember, at the Democratic, he was kind of a pushover. He was a, I don't think the Pentagon and the intelligence services and all that found him much of a challenge. remember, we had last year at the Democratic convention, I wrote a column about this, nobody else even blinked. We had a general on the platform endorsing Hillary saying, look, you better realize if a President Trump gave an order that we did not think was wise, we would seriously have to question whether we would follow it out. This was on the platform at the Democratic convention. I invite your listeners
yeah.
to think about the implications of that by way of civilian control over the military.
Wow, okay. That is fascinating. So the military is back in the saddle again, as it were.
Well, you know, Bert, I just find it, as I say to people who write letters in response to my columns, I'm really running out of adjectives. I just... don't know, not in my lifetime, and I include the Cold War decades,
me too.
Have I seen anything so disturbing as what is going on in this country. It's just dysfunction everywhere you look, We have my genealogy, or my etymology of it, is as follows. I think we've had a complete collapse of principled disinterest in our institutions.
Mm.
In other words, the media, God, it's sinful. The media, the intelligence agencies, the Justice Department, the political parties, okay, maybe we leave them out, they are declared as interested. But institutions that are supposed to be, to function on the basis of disinterest, don't. There's been a collapse of this, okay?
Mm.
In consequence, we have a drastic collapse of institutional authority. And I don't think anybody, some listeners may be older than I am, but probably not too many.
Sure.
I don't think anyone can say we've had anything like this in our lifetime.
No,
as American citizens, we are really at sea. I don't know. We go on from day to day on the basis of assumptions that simply do not hold. I had an old farmhouse here in Norfolk once, and a builder came in to fix one little thing and came downstairs and said, "Patrick, I don't know what's holding your second floor up." Well, it's kind of like that in this country. I don't know how long we can go on like this.
Well, and there still could be war with North Korea. I mean, it is actually possible. I've thought about, I mean, I was around, you know, in 1962 for the Cuban Missile Crisis, and, you know, it feels a lot like that. And, you know, I think there's a serious danger right now. And I must say, I remember that, you know, the Cuba knew that the United States had invaded them in 1961. And quite frankly, I thought it was difficult to see why Castro would like to deter another U.S.
Exactly.
invasion. So in researching for this discussion, I learned that the U.S. in the 1950s installed hundreds of nuclear weapons in South Korea, all aimed at North Korea. Apparently, Bush 1 took them out. But, you know, I wonder, I mean, the war of the 1950s on Korea, there was carpet bombing. More bombs were dropped on North Korea than had dropped on the entire Pacific theater during the Second World War.
Right.
Entire cities were destroyed. Dean Rusk, who became Secretary of State, said the U.S. bombed everything that moved in North Korea, every brick standing on top of another.
Right.
So
there is footage of this, Bert, but we don't get to see it. When you noted earlier, facts about North Korea that the rest of the world is perfectly aware of, but we either forgot or never knew.
Right.
This is what I'm talking about.
We
are not permitted this knowledge, but it's there. It doesn't change matters to keep 320 million Americans ignorant of it. Does not change matters. It just makes it more difficult for us to understand, which is the point, of course. We're not supposed to understand.
We're not supposed to understand. Absolutely, that's what history is, and the main purpose of official history, I think, is to erase things that we don't want to see. And, you know, I'm reminded of the so-called secret war in Cambodia that Nixon did in 1970. It wasn't secret to the people of Cambodia.
You know, it's striking. We're straying a little bit.
Yeah, well.
You know, the phrase covert operation, way back when, goodness knows, to discover that America had a covert op,
yes,
in some place like Iran or somewhere in Latin America, whatever, okay,
yeah,
typically in the developing world, but not only in the developing world, Europe too,
mm-hmm,
was kind of a big thing. Oh my God, a covert operation. That's not right.
Right. I remember that.
Now, we talk about covert operations, it's water off a duck's back. Nobody has any hesitation or nobody ever questions them. My position on these things is as follows. any agency, any American agency that indulges in covert operations abroad has absolutely no respect for, well, never mind the government target.
Right.
It has also, think about this, no respect for the principles we claim to live by. And if they don't have any respect for those principles, I really would like to hear why we should assume they are not willing to do the same thing at home that they do abroad, okay?
Mm-hmm. True.
Taking down Trump, as we've just discussed, I consider in the same file, okay?
Interesting.
A lot went on that we were not permitted to see. And this, once again, is why I take very serious issue with liberals who have been willing to climb on, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a... I tell you, they're the pebble in my shoe at the moment, not Donald Trump.
Interesting. Well, certainly in terms of foreign policy, in terms of, you know, military adventures throughout the world, there has been that division within the Democratic Party for a very long
yes.
time. Long, long time. I am of the wing of the party, Paul Wellstone called the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. It doesn't do that kind of thing. And
Cold War liberals, Bert.
Cold War liberals, right.
They have their offspring. They multiply like rabbits.
They did. And Hillary Clinton was certainly one. I guess she still is. We started talking about North Korea, and we haven't really strayed very far because it's all part of the same animal. You know, what's truth, what's not, what's civilian government, what's military government. Syria is a very long way from North Korea and China, of course. But in terms of messaging, apparently there's no distance at all. You wrote that Sheirat, I don't know if I pronounced that right, the place.
I don't either. I've never been there.
Well, it was that air base in Syria that we bombed
right.
with 59 missiles. Sheirat is to Beijing.
Sheirat, I would have said, yeah, right.
What is it?
Sheirat, I would have said.
Sheirat, okay. Sheirat is to Beijing as Hiroshima was to Moscow long ago. Please say more about what you meant by that.
Sure. Let's start with Hiroshima and Moscow. One quite prominent interpretation of Washington's motivation to drop in Hiroshima in August of 1945 was because the war was very near its end. It was plain the Japanese weren't going to hold out much longer. And we had to face the post-surrender situation in the Pacific. What were the Soviets going to do? We wanted to keep them out of the Pacific to the fullest extent we can. Moscow and Tokyo are still arguing about four forlorn little islets called the Northern Territories. Off the northern coast of Japan, right? So it was the interpretation is it was a message to Stalin. This is what we've got. You don't have it, and we're willing to use it. Watch. We're going to prove we're willing to use it because we're going to use it. I am given to that interpretation.
Oh,
so
of course.
That's Hiroshima, Moscow. All right. Xi Jinping is scheduled to have his summit at Mar-a-Lago.
Yes.
And he arrives, I believe, on a Friday. That evening at dinner, Tillerson is there breathing fire about chemical weapons in Syria. They know very well this was a planted provocation. Right. They to this day will not allow a proper investigation.
Mm.
And as I noted, the MIT scientist Postol, P-O-S-T-O-L,
I appreciate that.
Has done an extraordinary scientific paper proving beyond the shadow of a doubt that it was not an airdropped munition. It was planted in the ground by those anti-Assad troops we insist on calling moderates. He did wind direction and all the rest of it. That evening, she arrived on a Friday. That evening, Trump leaned over and said, "Mr. President, we have just fired 59 cruise missiles at an airfield in Syria. You need to know this." Anyone who thinks that that was not intentional really needs to be a little better versed in politics and diplomacy, right? It was plainly rehearsed. She said to his interpreter, "Excuse me, would you ask Mr. Trump to say that again?" When Trump did, and the interpretation came back the same, she was silent, and he was by all accounts astonished, and he knew he had a situation on his hands, and he knew North Korea was the true topic of that dinner. That's what I mean.
So, yeah, sure, it makes sense. So that, yeah, just as we attacked Hiroshima and
events
Nagasaki,
have proven out this interpretation, of course.
Well, if you just tuned in, Keeping Democracy Live, Bert Cohen here. I am your host, and our guest today is Patrick Lawrence, foreign policy columnist at The Nation. We're talking about North Korea, what's real, what's not. And before starting research for this discussion, I had certainly never heard of a missile defense system called THAAD, Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, which I believe at the Pentagon's...
I love these Pentagon acronyms, don't you?
Oh, yeah, like Mother of All Bombs. Which I believe the Pentagon's insistence is now set up in South Korea, the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. What is it? How did South Koreans and the Chinese react to its placement there?
It's an interesting question, Bert. Thanks for it. It's quite a key dimension of our conversation. THAAD, we'll call it. Is a very, very advanced, right off the assembly line anti-missile system, the highest end technology around. And we were negotiating with the government of Park Geun-hye to install it in North Korea. Park is the daughter of Park Chung-hee, one of our favorite dictators. And she was of the mold, right? She was on for it, far rightist, very hostile to North Korea. She was going to do it. Problems arose when Park was accused of corruption, and things went very swiftly south, and she was deposed. Well, the THAAD system was... in negotiation, just before she was taken down, Park allocated the necessary land. These sort of odd details can be important at times. Allocated the necessary land. I think she took it away from a department store or something for the THAAD system. Then she was taken down, and her prime minister, chip off the old block, Huang, his name is, took over as acting president. He is acting president now. What do you know but the Pentagon is over there in a flash? The first components of this, it's not operational yet. The first components of this system were shipped within days of the collapse of the Park government. We are now rushing it into place. Here's our problem, and it's very interesting. I invite your readers to watch what happens this spring. The leading Huang, the acting president, is out as of May 9th. There's a presidential election, May 7, May 9. I get them mixed up with the French.
Right,
He's out as of early May. He's gone. We had Mattis, we had Tillerson, and most recently we had Pence, all passing through South Korea. That's a lot of heavyweight tonnage.
Yeah.
In terms of senior American officials
yeah.
walking through Seoul, very unusual. It's all about Thad, you see. They spoke with Hwang at great length, yes. They have a presidential election coming. They have a leading candidate. There are 11 or 12 candidates. Of them, the opposition Democratic candidate, his name is Moon, has, of 11 candidates, he's got 36% in the polls at my last look. In other words, he's way out front.
Right.
They didn't even meet him.
I noticed.
They didn't even meet him.
Please explain
They're
why.
They're talking to a lame duck.
Why didn't they meet with Moon Jae-in?
I really invite your readers. Listeners, beg your pardon.
They read.
To watch this situation this spring. We've been doing this to the South Koreans since 1953. The many, many South Koreans, thousands, maybe millions, have relatives in the North. They are very given. I can't say they, not all. Many, many South Koreans are very given to a peaceable reunification of the country. That's why Kim Dae-jung was elected president. It's why Kim Yong-sung preceded him. And this so-called sunshine policy, a kind of detente with the North, fortified by investment, family reunion policies, and so on. This is, Moon wants to revive this policy, and of course revive talks. No Americans are even bothering to talk to him.
Wow.
So it starts to look as if one way or another, the Americans are going to pretending to have their way in South Korea, as if it's as if the country is a third world nothing back in the 1950s. Right.
Mm.
It could be really very sad. I wish, I know South Koreans well. I covered the place for years. I wish them very well.
Well, that is frightening. And what about the Chinese? And obviously, Xi was rather freaked out. I mean, clearly the bombing of Syria was intended to send a message to him.
Right.
How were they reacting to this new American heat aimed at North Korea?
They are more or less beside themselves. They're quite upset. They have argued for years there is only one solution to the North Korean situation, now crisis, and that is talks between two parties, Pyongyang and Washington. There is no other place to look for a solution to this, and there is no solution other than a negotiated solution. This has been Beijing's bedrock position for ages, okay? The six-party talks I mentioned earlier were all about putting the Americans and the North Koreans on opposite sides of the same mahogany table. They want these talks. It is their neighborhood. They are very frightened of a military confrontation. They find President Trump, number one, as unpredictable as the rest of us, and number two, I think they understand very well now that he's not running policy anymore. The Pentagon is Defense Secretary Mattis. They know from their own... Here's a big one I'm going to drop on your listeners.
Okay.
They know from their own experience during the communist period, the quotation marks Red China period, that deterrence, remember the Chinese are nuclearized, that deterrence is absolutely vital to national security when confronted by a nuclear power, right? no issue, especially if it's the United States. We used to love deterrence, we Americans. The golden word of the Cold War, remember?
Oh, sure.
We don't like deterrence, as I pointed out in one of the columns. We don't like deterrence when we are the ones being deterred. Here's my big one for your listeners. We must not hope the North Koreans give up their nuclear programs until there are negotiations. We really do want them to continue their programs until the Americans are willing to sit down. Anything else is very dangerous, and we are the source of the danger. Better face that. It's very bitter, but it's so.
Well, I have to ask for more clarification on that. So it's in, say, the American military's interest for the North to keep on their, you know, nuclear saber-rattling?
No, it's in your interest and mine if you want a safe world. Tillerson made the most disingenuous of many remarks on this topic the other week. He said, look, Washington will do anything to avoid talks. They simply don't want them. Huh. The danger being, ultimately, your listeners might think I'm speaking at an extreme, but I think it comes down to this.
You know,
we don't want talks because ultimately talks might lead to a solution. Tillerson came out and said, this is a real cream puff, right? We refuse to talk to the North Koreans until they drop their nuclear and missile program.
Yes, that's been clear.
Well, if you want to negotiate on North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, it is a rather flimsy starting point to say drop them first, right? That's what I mean by disingenuous. And no, I don't think it's in. I may have misunderstood your question before, but my position is we are very, very heavily reliant on deterrence right now, and
yes,
it's quite a bitter situation to reflect upon. But the only thing standing between another onslaught such as we were discussing in the early 50s is right now the North's nuclear program.
Wow. Interesting. I always learn a lot from you.
Well, this is where the Pentagon's idea of foreign policy gets us.
So the Pentagon, what they want now, see if I got this right.
Yeah.
The Americans see, you know, we want to basically own and control that territory. And if there's talks, actual respectful talks with Pyongyang, that falls apart.
Yeah, they don't. Yes, the Americans are on the record as not wanting to talk. That's plain.
So when we put pressure on China to do something, are they in a position to tell North Korea what to do or not to do?
No, they don't. The Chinese don't. Well, they don't. They don't have two things. They don't have nearly the influence over North Korea that we assume. Okay, it's a long and very complicated relationship.
Yeah.
They don't have the influence we assume, and two, they don't have the motivation. Right. They don't want the Pyongyang regime to collapse. They'll have a refugee crisis. They have economic reasons, political reasons, strategic reasons, or for decades, diplomatic reasons. For decades, the North has served as a convenient, if not very attractive, buffer for the Chinese on their northern border. Okay, that's just cold hard facts. They don't want a calamitous end to that regime. They emphatically want a denuclearized
situation.
Korean Peninsula.
I bet.
Which that was a big word back in the 90s, denuclearization. But I think they understand, as I said in that column you may have on your desk, the Chinese have strenuously urged the North to cut out the missile tests, and they're seem to be getting ready for a sixth underground nuclear detonation. The Chinese have said no nuclear detonation and cut out the missile tests. For your own security, they said, right? I have never in my life seen a Chinese document or heard any Chinese official telling the North Koreans to unilaterally disarm.
Right, for sure.
That's what I mean by deterrence. The Chinese know this themselves from their own experience.
So is it possible that at that Mar-a-Lago dinner that she had, in fact, felt the heat and may work with Trump now to keep putting pressure on Pyongyang and North Korea?
No. Well, look, no, we're being misled in the papers. We're being misled.
I'm shocked.
Trump explicitly said the other day, and the Times and other newspapers have been implying for weeks that Beijing is coming over to our side, and they're really with us, and they're going to, you know, they're on our side against the North, and so on and so forth. Trump,
yeah,
as I said a moment ago, is quite explicit on this a few days ago.
Oh, yeah.
None of it's true. The Chinese are indeed interested in defusing this situation. There is no question. They will do what they can at the margins to reduce the level of tension such that talks might proceed. Any thought that they are on for some kind of regime change or major
right.
disturbance of the North Korean political structure is completely off. I don't think the Chinese like it, but I think it's a bit like Syria, you see. You don't have to like Assad
right.
to understand that removing him is very unwise.
Terrible.
We'll have another Libya on our hands, right?
Yeah.
Chaos. Yeah. It is the same. You don't have to admire the Kim dynasty or whatever you wish to call it to understand that you can't just knock it over.
Right.
That's the Chinese position. As I said in that column, when we can't persuade the Chinese to do what we want, we pretend that they are. I don't know who benefits from it.
Oh, my goodness. Pretending gets us nowhere, I don't think. Always fascinating to talk to you, Patrick Lawrence. If people want to follow your stuff, I know they can look at The Nation. I'm assuming there's some other website.
Pleasure. Yes. PatrickLawrence.us.
Thank you so much for being with us and shedding a lot of light into this dark and scary area.
I hope so. Complicated matters.
Yes.
I hope I did some good.
Thank you so much, Patrick Lawrence.
Pleasure. You're welcome.